I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Speaking to Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, we're discussing not only the history of the mutually assured destruction theory that was in action in the 20th century until the end of the Soviet Union, but the reintroduction of what will be nuclear parity if Vladimir Putin's words most recently about the new nuclear-tipped weapon systems they're deploying is factual, and the U.S. matches it with equally inventive ways to kill hundreds of millions of people. That was the culture of the 20th century. I understand that we're speaking to many young people who were children or were not with us in the 20th century. It becomes an art to interpret this. How do you carry on with the idea that strangers can destroy everything around you and also destroy the other side of the planet? What's left? That was the nature of mutually assured destruction. There are some wonderful movies that speak to this absurdity. The best, of course, is Dr. Strangelove. However, inside Dr. Strangelove, there are actual debates about who wins a nuclear exchange in which tens of millions of people are killed as a result of that exchange. Steve is addressing now Vladimir Putin cogently presenting a story that can be matched by our side. President Trump can tell a story about what are the risks of nuclear parity. Or as George C. Scott said it, as General Turgeson to his president, President Muffley, I'm not saying we won't get our hair mussed, Mr. President. So, Steve, let's continue with what hair mussing will look like in Vladimir Putin's mind and in Donald J. Trump's mind. Please continue.
Well, but these young people you just spoke to, having not lived through what you and I lived through, need to understand that their fathers and their grandfathers who ran this country, and ran the Soviet Union, those fathers and grandfathers, came to understand, partly, by the way, as a result of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when we came so close to war, nuclear war with Russia, and other events, came to understand that this couldn't go on, that there had to be an agreement. And that's why both sides embrace the idea of parity. Parity meaning, again, that neither side would acquire a strategic nuclear edge that might tempt it into a first strike. And that's why we had all the arms control agreements. That's why we had the agreement banning missile defense installations. By the way, in the ABM treaty, each side was allowed one. Moscow put its around Moscow. Russia did. We put ours, was it in South Dakota? I don't remember where. But each side was allowed only one. That understanding of the fathers and the grandfathers, I speak to our young listeners now, was violated, broken, repudiated in Washington after the Soviet Union ended. For what reasons? That's a separate issue. By the way, John, there's a sidebar story here that I don't think you and I can answer. But these remarkable technological developments, and if true, they really are remarkable, were they known to American intelligence during these past 15 years? And particularly since Putin says they came into development and even deployment in the last 5 or 6 years, did the CIA, did the National Security Agency, did the other intelligence agencies, that of the Defense Department, know about all this? They have been stunningly silent since Putin gave the speech. If they didn't know, what were they doing? Were they busy with Russiagate type of nonsense? Were they busy listening to Americans instead of studying Russian military doctrine and reading the newspapers? I mean, how much of this was known? It's a mystery, but we should be told.
And Steve, I want to introduce the...
Maybe
the,
you know.
I want to introduce the possibility that when we started this conversation during the Ukraine crisis, 2013-2014, always implicit was, this can't be turned off. Every week, Steve, we talked about it. This can't be turned off. This is the new Cold War and it can't be turned off. The logic of what we were saying is now apparent with these new weapon systems from Vladimir Putin. But I can recall thinking to myself, no, we can't mean this. We can't be going back to that. I can remember week after week, Steve, although I would advocate for the logic of it as if it was a one-way road to Hades, I couldn't believe that we'd spend our resources again matching throw weight and talking about cruise missiles that can't be stopped, or having a defense minister who talked about holes in the NATO umbrella. But here we are. It's as if we're in an alternative universe, Steve. And if Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev were here today, they'd say, where did we fail? How did we let this happen?
Well, Gorbachev is here today. I mean, he is in Moscow.
And he's in despair, according to the reports that you've given me.
He is in despair because he senses, he feels, he knows, and he's right, that the legacy he created to end Cold War and nuclear arms race forever, and he gives Reagan full credit. He always says, my partner, Ronald Reagan, that legacy that those two men gave us in 1989 was lost. It was squandered. It was done willfully. Washington knew what it was doing after the Soviet Union ended. It was tempted by triumphalism, by a misunderstanding of how and why the Soviet Union had ended, by this notion that history had ended, that now the globe belonged to the United States. And this where it led, John. I'm struck, because before I say a few words about the politics of this, Putin kept saying during the speech, you didn't listen to me. I mean, he's been in power, 18 years, right? He came to power in 2000. He said, you didn't listen to me. I protested this. I made offers. I said, let's
do
this together.
You listened. Steve, you did listen. You said this was implicit. We talked about the hawks who were in the Kremlin pressuring him to turn it off to resolve the conflict in Ukraine. Before we came to Syria, before we came to the Baltic states, you said each week he needs a partner in Washington, meaning Barack Obama. He needed somebody to turn it off.
Yes, and I'd go farther tonight and say that if you read this speech carefully, it's hard not to conclude that the hawks wrote part of it. There are passages in this speech that are lifted almost verbatim from the publications of the hawks, which have thought all along that Putin was too soft, not resolute enough. And I don't think that the people in this country who were supposed to listen to what's said in Moscow, listen the way they did during the last Cold War. Putin gave an enormously important speech explaining why Russia had annexed Crimea. This was in 2014, just about exactly 4 years ago, March. And he explained that this had been imposed on Russia, and he went through the history of it. And I remember Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State, but considered to be a big Russia expert in this country and an authoritative commentator on Russia, said, I don't even bother reading Putin's speech because it's all fiction and lies.
Madeleine Albright had a great deal of authority in 2014 with the Obama administration.
She did. And, I mean, for somebody like Madeleine Albright to say it's all fiction and lies, you understand Putin's frustration when he talked and talked and talked.
I would ask you, Steve, week after week, how's he putting up with the hawks? And you would say that there was a team in the White House, in the Kremlin, that wanted to just get it over with and take Kiev. Remember, those conversations were going on for months, and then the shoot down over Ukraine, and it turned dire when Angela Merkel, the chancellor of all the Germans, weighed in and said, Putin, you must turn this off, and started making accusations about how this is all Russian aggression. And you would say again and again, he's holding back the hawks.
Except we now know, don't we, John, that behind the scenes, he was giving the hawks, if that's the right word, because I guess
it's the Russian war party is what it is.
But they look to many Russians to be wise people. He was giving them the funds to develop these weapons against missile defense, which brings us, if we can, a little bit to the underlying politics and policy making revealed by Putin's remarkable speech. And again, I really urge people to read it for themselves. They could do so at our website, eastwestaccord.com. Putin refers to his speech as a turning point. That is, not the speech itself, but what he's telling us about the weapons that Russia's developed. And he says something quite remarkable. Do you remember, John, in a few broadcasts, I've said that Putin has referred to having had illusions, but he never spelled them out? He said this on three or four occasions, that I had my illusions. I had to get over my illusions. And in the speech, he says, and this is really astonishing because national leaders never take blame for anything. He says, we ourselves are to blame for the situation. He means their strategic peril, their lack of defense. We ourselves are to blame for this situation. And I think he's referring to these illusions he mentioned earlier. And when he keeps saying, you wouldn't listen to me, he talked so long for so many years, thinking that the people he calls his partners in Washington would finally listen, that the illusion was he believed eventually they would listen. And in the speech he said, all right, you didn't listen. Now I'm going to show you what we've done. Will you listen now? But in a way, the speech is critical of Putin himself. Putin is self-critical. He had to put aside these illusions. And why does he call this a turning point? And why do I call it a historic speech? Now, the first thing that's happened, again, is that the entire American approach, strategic approach, to post-Soviet Russia was to gain superiority. That was the essence of these missile defense installations, of which we now have, I think, something like on land and sea, approaching 40, from the United States to the Black Sea, to South Korea, Japan. One is operating in Romania, very close to Russia. Another is to open, I think, within a year in Poland. But we now have about 40 of these missile installations. And it's a fairy tale that they're aimed at Iran or North Korea. They were built to contain Russia's capacity to retaliate. Putin nowhere in the speech uses the expression arms race. But he makes it clear that we are now at a historic moment of decision. And here's what he says. You didn't think we could do this. You thought we were incapable because we were no longer the Soviet Union. We were small. We were poor. We were in ruins in the 1990s. But we are a magnificent nation. Our scientists, our engineers, our geniuses. He went on at great length about how young they are, that a whole new generation had come into the defense program. He says, you all get medals, but now is not the time for medals. That's later. I mean, it's very, very interesting. He never uses the expression new arms race, but here's what he said, and I'll strip it down. He says, to your surprise, America's surprise, we caught up with you during these last 15 years. We reacquired parity. You not only do not have nuclear superiority, but if we want to, we can elude your missile defense installations. We've defeated you. He's almost saying there was an arms race, and we won. And now the ball's in your corner. What do you want to do about it? And he says, I propose, now that we've restored nuclear parity, that we do what our, he doesn't use this expression, but to stay with our idiom, we do what our fathers and grandfathers did, beginning in the 60s and 70s and 80s. They sat down and they negotiated on the basis of parity to eliminate the dangers, and agree, and to codify them in treaties, and to make the world safe. He says, but I know what you're going to do. He says, you're going to see what we've achieved, and you're going to try to surpass us. That is, you will engage us in another race. And then he says, maybe you'll catch up. That's technology. Maybe you can do what we did and catch up.
Hold on, Steve.
We will then surge ahead again.
The arms race is on. Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University. We will return to the exciting non-conclusion of an arms race for the 21st century. I'm John Batchelor. Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University is here. We're talking about the arms race of the new Cold War, the new mutually assured destruction, and Steve's remarks point to the inevitability of this getting more expensive and more dangerous. I remind you all of Buck Turgidson, played by George C. Scott in the great movie Strangelove, which I assign to everyone under 30 right now to understand where you are and where your tax dollar is going to go for the rest of your life, unless Turgidson said to President Muffley, asking about this potential of a nuclear weapons exchange, "Mr. President, I'm not saying we wouldn't get our hair mussed, but I do say no more than 10 to 20 million killed tops, depending on the breaks." That, in the depths of the Cold War in 1960, when I was a very young person, passed as very sober humor. Hardly anybody laughed. It's easy to roar now, but it was an accurate display of what both great nations had as their national strategy: destroy tens of millions of people. Please continue, Professor.
Well, you have framed what's at stake. You used a movie, but it was a profound movie. And I, too, saw it, and I remember it. Strangelovian has become the adjective we now use for what's at stake. So Putin ends by saying to Washington, "It's your choice. We've caught up. You didn't think we could, but we did. We now have strategic parity with you. We don't want superiority. So you have a choice, Washington. You can now make another attempt to gain superiority, and maybe you will catch us. We understand the prowess of American technology. But now you must understand what we can do. And if you catch us, we will surge ahead again. And then you will try to surge ahead. And that will mean nuclear arms race forever. I," says Putin, "am now prepared to put an end to this. Let us sit down and negotiate a safe international strategic order." And on that, he ends. So, my editorial, John, and for this, no doubt, I will be traduced. I think Putin is amply sincere, and I think he's correct. If you read the other two-thirds of his speech that come before this weapons section, where he sets out his vision for Russia during his next six-year term as president, which he'll certainly win on the 18th of March, you can see that his mission and the legacy he wants to leave behind has nothing to do with being a superpower in the world. It's with modernizing Russia and making it prosperous. But for that, he needs an end to this nuclear arms race. So he ends by saying, "We are ready. We are ready for negotiations." And so that leaves us, John, you, me, our listeners, with this question: is Washington ready? Would Washington now, even if it believes everything Putin has set out in terms of what Russia has acquired by way of weapons, is it ready to sit down and talk with Russia? I have grave doubts. One reason is that parity, which originated as a term applied to strategic weapons, also meant political parity. That is, Russia, then the Soviet Union, had co-equal, legitimate strategic and national interests. If you regard the other side as somehow illegitimate, you will never agree to nuclear parity. And the problem is that Putin and Putin's Russia have been so demonized for so long. This notion that begun with Obama and has continued with Trump's generals, that American policy should be to isolate and delegitimize Putin's Russia, is the antithesis of the attitude, the thinking you need to enter into nuclear arms agreements based on parity. So that demonization of Russia and of Putin seems to me to be an enormous obstacle. And finally, everybody knows we now have Russiagate. Even if President Trump, and they say he doesn't read, but somebody explains to him, or he's listening to us tonight, he understands, and his intelligence people say, yes, Putin has these weapons, and Putin wants to negotiate. And Trump says, so do I. And this means a new detente. Could he do it? Professor, could he do it when every day he's called a puppet or an agent of the Kremlin?
Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University. I'm John Benjamin.
Sunny day.